This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Sanebox, where Inbox Zero is just one click away.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average tops 21,000. S&P at record closing high. The House passes the health care bill. Unemployment rate drops to 4.4%. The French elections, stories from Cuba, listener questions, all this and much more on episode number 508 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there, Andrew Horowitz here, and it is now May 7th, 2017. And here we are with another wonderful week of interesting things that have happened in the markets, as well as lots to talk about what's coming up, because we have some interesting news about how the French elections actually played out, some economic numbers that are coming, as well as a variety of fiscal stimulus that has been possibly set in motion now that could change the general, well, I would say, the feeling about where we are with the markets, valuations, and what could be the future moving forward. But yes, the S&P 500 did hit a closing high, as well as the NASDAQ again. Dow Jones Industrial Average, not there quite yet, but did top 21,000 in a very quick move at the end of the trading day on Friday. Just a major amount of optimism that Macron would be winning the election over the weekend in France over Le Pen. And it appears from the most recent and updated poll information that has come in that there is a pretty wide margin in terms of the votes for Macron. And that is a centrist policy rather than a radical right conservative policy, with the idea that France would pull out of the EU. We have a much more business-focused and a much more central ideology style that will be in place for France for some time. I wasn't quite sure that there would be the run towards Le Pen, because it was so radical, the idea. And everybody's like, oh, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. We saw what happened with Brexit, and we saw what happened with Trump, and we saw what happened in various areas where the conservatives gained power and popularity, and the polls numbers before the election showed that it was going to be won, and all these surprises came, and there was this idea that there's going to be so many more surprises on a regular basis because somehow the poll numbers were always off, and they led towards the more, I would say, stay is the same type of play that we've had for some time in the last 10 years. And then all of a sudden, when the actual vote took place and the votes were tallied, that would be, well, just a total reversal surprise. So maybe or maybe not, these surprises that we saw were isolated and we're back towards a much more realistic view of what's going on with the world. We don't want to upset every consideration that was put into play over the last 20 years. And maybe, just maybe, there's going to be the thought that, well, let's keep it somewhat in the center rather than going far right or far left and having some kind of crazy surprise here. But we'll see what happens. Now, what's going to happen is the big question with the euro, the currency, on this news. Into the close and into the week, we saw a rise in the euro as the idea that this centrist, this business-focused leader that would be better for the business environment for France and to keep the EU together would be looking like more and more they were gaining control, the upper hand on the election process. And now there is the idea that maybe the euro will actually strengthen pretty significantly. I thought it was really fascinating how the handicapping of what would happen if this one or that one got into office. So if Macron got into office, well, we're going to see a stronger euro. If Le Pen got into office, there is a chance for, wouldn't you guess it, a stronger euro. Almost on every side, there was the idea that no matter what happened, the euro would strengthen here. But I think clearly there was the idea that the euro over about, and it's approaching this level, 110 to the dollar would be something to look at. Actually, 110 on the euro USD, I should say. So 110, the euro was strengthening. The higher it gets in that currency conversion or that currency comparison, it is a stronger euro. When it drops, it's a weaker euro. So we're about at 109 and change on the euro. And 110 seems to be a pretty interesting resistance area. Major resistance on that level that may see some buyers scrambling to get in and clearly some shorts covering. I would not be too surprised if we saw a significant pop in the euro. Now, what would that mean? Well, recently we saw that even with the passage of the House bill to repeal and replace and to have this new healthcare bill, we'll talk about that in a second, and it did pass last week, right before Congress once again went on vacation or took a time off. And this was seen as a major and important point in the Republican transition and their campaign pledges, I guess we would call it. That's the best way to, I guess, campaign pledges to make good on it. And they needed a win. They clearly needed a win. And I find it very fascinating, by the way, about this whole idea of we need a win versus let's do what's best. But right now, every side is looking for a win. They want to win more than anything. It's like a ball game or something. It's like there's one side against the other side, and we need to win. And if we win, we're going to celebrate. And we'll talk about this whole thing in a second a little bit more. But to get back to the euro. So with this, and what we've seen over the last week or so was gold had been trailing off. It was up a bit on Friday. Gold miners have been getting eviscerated. The dollar at the same time has been actually dropping. Usually what you see is when the dollar drops, commodities that are priced in that currency will do better. So for example, there's been a long story and a long, I would say, well-received notion that oil does better with a weaker dollar. And the converse is true, of course. When the dollar is stronger, certain commodities like gold and oil will not do as well. Did you happen to watch what happened with oil last week as the dollar was continuing to go down? Oil hit, I think, 46 and change. I mean, it broke down really hard. Last week, we talked about how it broke through the $50 level. And this is even with the coaxing of Saudi Arabia saying that they will continue with the production cuts. But one of the things that happened was as these production cuts came into play and there was this rise in the price of oil as they were talking it up, saying that, yeah, OPEC and non-OPEC are going to come together and they're going to do what they can to shut down production so that we can stabilize the price of oil. And oil shot up from the 40s to the 50s. Now, remember what we talked about. We talked about this probably about, I would say, 5 or 6 weeks ago, how once oil started to come up, one of the problems you had was this overhead resistance, we'll call it, from a technical standpoint, but as well as the fact that as oil came up past the $50 mark, more and more frackers and drillers in the U.S. will come back online, those that were idled, and that could see a significant amount of new oil that is being brought up, then put into inventories because we know the demand's not there, offsetting all the work, the jawboning, and the production cuts by OPEC. And that's exactly what happened. Now, it was a mystery as far as how far it would go. So, you know, as an investor trying to handicap how far something will move on jawboning and how far it will move beyond fundamentals, is very difficult in an environment where you have either central banks, sovereign wealth funds, politicians talking their book because they have a lot of power. Some have unlimited money and some have no oversight. They could do whatever they want. OPEC can say whatever they want. Nobody's coming in saying, you know, that's not true. And if you're going to say that again, you're going to go to jail. There's nobody overseeing this whole thing. Central banks can talk about how they're going to raise rates, lower rates, keep rates. There's really nobody overseeing any of this. Now, Congress would like to oversee that. There's a bill right now that looks to have the Fed work on a different measure. Right now, they pretty much shoot from the hip. Right now, they go in and say, well, the economy is doing this, inflation's doing that. We see this as either temporary or permanent, and the unemployment rate is at this level. But however, we see that there's slack in the unemployment area or the employment area because of this. And they come up with all these scenarios, and they make a soft interpretation of it, and they say, okay, that's the numbers. Even though we thought that was going to be the level that we would start to raise rates really rapidly, we're going to hold off a little bit because of this reason or that reason. And they keep it almost as vague as what I've just said. they intentionally are vague in all this so that they keep you guessing. Now, what they want to do is have some hard numbers so that if we get to a certain unemployment rate or a certain inflation rate, the central bank is going to have to make a move and have to abide by a certain interest rate policy. This is what's being talked about in Congress right now. And as you would imagine, central bankers are not happy. They like to have their autonomy. And they also like to have a range of possibilities of what they can do without. I mean, essentially, if there is a hard, true, and a fact-based, numbers-based level of overall, you know, what the Fed has to do if this happens. So in other words, if there is a number at 4.3% unemployment and inflation is at 2% on an annualized basis, this is going to be the interest rate. What does that really do? It retires all of the central bankers. What do they have? What do they have to do? What is their job? If their job is to interpret the data and then therefore make policy based on their best information and sources that are in all of the research that's at hand, and then try to look at not only what's happening, the trends, but also what they project what will happen in the future, there's not going to be any need for that if there is a simple process that is essentially automated. It's like a robo-central banker. So that's kind of right now that's being debated. We see a lot of these central bankers kicking and screaming and squirming at the same time, trying their best to convince Congress that, no, we don't need this. We don't need anybody overseeing us. We don't need any checks and balances. We don't need to be audited. We don't need to have an automation. We can do it ourselves, and we don't want anybody butting in the process because we think what we've done is pretty good here. But the problem is right now for central bankers that this populism, this more conservative side of what's happening around the world, is really pretty much the antithesis of central bank freedom and autonomy. It's going to be very fascinating to watch exactly how this plays out. And if, in fact, one central bank around the world or the other is going to be subject to some kind of oversight and rule. Now, I mentioned that the House passed the American Healthcare Act. The American Healthcare Act. This was the repeal and replace of Obamacare and how they had a better plan that was going to save you money and that was going to cover everybody and be the best in the world, the best plans and all this. A lot of the momentum was gained recently with the realization that if they don't pass this, there's not enough money to do any kind of the tax reform that they wanted to do. So they appeased, as they do often, they appeased some of the players in the House that were voting against this, the Freedom Caucus in particular. And they said, you know, what we'll do is we'll make some adjustments to Medicaid. And I think the Congressional Budget Office came out and said that if the plan passes as it is today, as it has passed, that about $800 billion will be saved from Medicaid. In other words, there'll be lower Medicaid payments and there'll be a change in the whole structure of how Medicaid is handled right now. And without getting into the minutiae of all that, obviously what we're seeing is that the current plan as it stands that was recently voted in by the House, of course, it has to go through the Senate. And I'm not sure how that whole party is going to come out and whether or not it's going to be bear any resemblance to the current bill as it was voted in just last week, or if it's going to be completely different. And then that has to be, of course, ratified. So I think, by the way, just to kind of give you 2 cents here, is I would think that the Senate is going to have a very significant change. There will be a lot of things that will be on the table. And of course, the senators will want to get a little bit and put in their own pork and their own plans and their own money grabs to make sure that they, say, oh, well, you know, I'll vote for it if you put this in there. But, you know, it's back to this whole idea of a win. We need to win. We need to win at all costs. Now, with the unemployment rate of 4.5% or 4.4%, and with the inflation rate where it is, manufacturing being where it is, I'm not quite sure where we get to the benefit, except for the fact that we said, oh, we need a 3% GDP. Let me ask you something. Are things so bad? Housing looks good. Manufacturing, and that looks good. Retail, that's a different story. I think it's more of a change in buying habit more than it is necessarily, you know, it's a changing of the times. It's these old dinosaur of companies, the big box retailers and some of the smaller stores, they're not competing as well with some of the online deals that are out there, the Walmarts, the discounters, et cetera. I don't think we need to save them if they can't change with the times. Do you? So what is it that exactly we need to do, and why do we need to have a 3 or 4% GDP? Is it going to be that much better? Stock market's at all-time high, earnings are doing great, 12% gain in EPS or earnings per share growth over the last year. Revenue's holding up. What do we need to do? We need to supercharge this for some reason? We need to look at the idea of pulling the tax deductibility of 401k plans, making it 401k Roth plans, where there's tax deferral and long-term opportunity to grow your money and then take it out tax-free instead of getting an upfront tax deduction today. Because why? We need to win. I think that it is very admirable and agreeable that we'd want to have a 3% GDP rate. But I don't think we should do it at the expense of our future. That's where I have a problem with all this. So with this healthcare bill, the idea was, oh, this is great. And all the congressmen got on the front lawn of the White House. And Paul Ryan made a speech. It was like an acceptance speech for an Academy Award. I want to thank this person and that person for all the great opportunities they gave us. And I don't think we've ever seen something like that, because we know that the law is not passed unless they're trying to fool us somehow. But the law is not passed till it goes through the Senate. And we also know there was a lot of flaws in this current version that will have to be ironed out significantly, not just in a small way. And that could take months. I'm not quite sure if they're going to try to get the next thing going through the House, which is some kind of a tax bill where there's going to be cuts to both the corporate and the personal rates and simplification of the overall tax process. But it'll be interesting to see if they try to use this as a jumping off point for the next area they want to really focus in on, which is taxes. Now, before we get on and move on to some of the economics that happened and what the Fed Reserve did and some of the manufacturing numbers, I need to just mention and ask you something. what's going on with your emails? You got an email box like I used to have, which, you know, you look on your phone and it shows you like 1,000 emails are just waiting for you. It's overwhelming, right? What do you do with something like that? You ever see people have like 25,000 emails, a little, they give you their phone and you look at it and you're like, wait, why do you have 25,000 on your emails of unread emails? Something's wrong with that. I think the thing is that most of these people didn't hear about something as simple as Samebox. Samebox has been a sponsor of ours and they've been a great sponsor for some time. And I want to tell you something, that they've done a great job at bringing just a terrific promotion, because they want you to understand how easy it is to get to that inbox zero. They want you to understand that you don't have to have 25,000, 1,000, or even 500 unopened emails, and seeing that it wastes so much time during your day trying to just thumb through all of those junk emails and those emails of unwanted people and trying to unsubscribe. It's just a lot easier using this same box, because what happens is that it basically, it sorts through your email for you. It moves all your trivial and your insignificant emails to a different folder. So only the messages that you want to see are actually the ones that you do see. They have this great little, the thing they call the black hole. Basically what happens is you take an email, you move it into this little folder, it says black hole. And from then on, you don't get emails from that party anymore. And pretty much takes them into oblivion. It's rewarding and a major time saver. So what I want you to do is go to sanebox.com/TDI. Make sure you do that. Sanebox.com/TDI. And basically you're going to get an extra $20 credit on top of a 2-week free trial. You don't have to enter a credit card or anything like that unless you decide to buy it. So there's nothing really to lose here. I want you to make sure to check this out, because you really, there's nothing like the stress of having an enormous amount of emails to deal with that are junk. It's one thing if all those emails are good, okay, you have to deal with it. But dealing with this junk and areas of emails from people you don't want to see, and check it out. Sanebox.com/TDI. Now, getting back to the week that was, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we need to know, because I think putting the economics into perspective is important. Even though right now we're in an environment that, as some would say, the data doesn't matter. Because even if we saw a lackluster unemployment number, like less people added to the payrolls, people are not concerned, because, you know, this tax is coming, there's regulations coming that maybe reduce other harsh regulations. We have the central bank to back us up at very low interest rates, and they won't really move as far as increasing rates too fast if they see weakness. As a matter of fact, last week, we saw that the central bank, the Fed, left the benchmark rate at the 0.75 to 1% target range last week. I can't wait, by the way, until we get off this range thing. I have a feeling the Fed wants to get off it too, where we have this 25 basis point range that, I mean, who gets what? Who gets the 75? Who gets the one? Why not just have the Fed funds rate at the rate? It's 1%, done. It's 1.25%, it's 0.75, whatever the number is. But what's with this range thing, and how do you get the lower end of it versus the higher end of it? Who gets that? Who makes that decision? But during their FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, they felt that, listen to this, that the poor economic growth in the first quarter was likely, as I always would say, you know, it's transitory. You never hear transitory when it's something that's actually good. So higher oil prices and transitory. Lower oil prices, that's good. Really good GDP, you don't hear it's transitory. You hear, oh, that's good. 0.7% GDP, and we thought we were going to get a 1.2. Oh, it's transitory. Don't worry about it. Just temporary. But they felt that economic activity should expand at a moderate pace with gradual monetary policy adjustments. So right now, the odds of a June rate hike are at about 80%. I would think post the French election, and if we see anything to the other side of maybe some pickup in economic activity, that we would see, in fact, pretty much a slam dunk that they'll raise the rate 0.25% to 1% to 1.25%. The range will be 1.0% to 1.25%. Got to have a range. Now, we did see also that the unemployment rate hit actually a 10-year low in April. There was new hires, about 211,000, and we saw a 4.4% unemployment rate. The U6, which is the larger number, takes a much larger picture of the employment situation, with underemployment, as we call it, hit 8.6%, fell about 0.3%, pretty good. Now, what was interesting, though, was that the Department of Commerce came out and they saw that spending still hasn't increased. Matter of fact, personal spending was flat in March, with personal incomes up 0.2%. And this is now, again, an interesting phenomenon where we're seeing that incomes are on the rise, but people aren't saving. Now, on DH Unplugged last week, we had a pretty thorough review of what this whole potential change in the structure of the 401k plans. It hasn't been voted in yet, but it's being thrown out there as a trial balloon. If in fact they move from deductibility of 401k plans for individuals, where you put your money into your 401k plan and it's pre-tax, to a post-tax and after-tax deposit, what would that mean? If you haven't listened to DH Unplugged and myself and John C. Dvorak talking about this, how it really messed around with savings and spending and the future, you need to listen to it. Just go to dhunplugged.com. But this very interesting environment where we're seeing that personal income is rising and spending is falling, you have to wonder what that's all about. Is it that the spending isn't happening because people are worried about the future and taking their money and saying, you know what, I'm not going to buy that car. I'm not going to buy that dress. I'm not going to buy those supplies. Because they're concerned about the future? When that makes no sense at all, because we saw that consumer confidence is at like multi-year decade highs. So yet they're confident about the future. They're making more money, but yet they're not spending it. Could it be a deflationary situation where prices are lower, thereby they're spending money on the same goods they've always bought, but those goods are a lower cost? That's possible. But I don't think it's that significant, because prices aren't coming down that much. Something we talked about in the past episode also was the whole idea that maybe everybody's just bloated. Maybe we don't need to buy anymore. Maybe we're kind of happy with what we're buying right now. We don't need any excess. Although that's not really aligned with what we know about human nature. People have money in their pocket and they pretty much spend it. They don't save it here in the U.S. They save some of it if they're forced to. We also saw that the factory sector, the ISM, we saw the ISM services and the ISM manufacturing or factory numbers came out last month about the latest month. And this is a switch, because over the last several months, we saw that the services sector, which is the majority of what we really rely on here in the U.S. from an economic standpoint, the services are a lot stronger. We know we really don't manufacture that much. We've offshored and outsourced so much of our manufacturing that right now services are the biggest component. And that is an important area, because that also shows us what individuals are really spending their monies on. Services can be linked more to individuals than manufacturing. I mean, manufacturing is important because individuals will buy and consumers will buy the finished goods. But really, the services are the first line. And what we saw over the last several months was that the the services sector was actually slowing down and manufacturing was picking up. And that was pretty much aligned with what we call the, quote, Trump trade, the reflationary trade, the jobs trade, the new idea that, you know, buy America, build America. The manufacturing number had been rising a bit, but services had been falling. This reversed this month. We saw that the ISM dipped on the manufacturing, dipped to 54. And non-manufacturing rose about 2.5 points to 57, which is good. That's a good thing. That's another good sign of the potential for the economy. Now, next week we have coming up, let's see, we have, of course, the election. That's going to, we'll see how that plays out. That should hit the markets on the overnight futures. By the way, this is aligned pretty well with the overnight futures that open up 6 p.m. on Sunday evening. Actually, you can start seeing at about 5 o'clock or so indications of currencies, sometimes a little bit earlier. But here's what we have. We have, obviously, the aftermath of the French election that will come out, and we'll see what happens throughout the evening. Also, earnings from Sysco and Tyson Foods, Sysco, the food company. On Tuesday, we're going to see earnings from Allergan, Discovery Communications, Valeant Pharmaceuticals, the once loved and now the most hated pharmaceutical company out there. On Wednesday, this is where it starts to get important. On Wednesday, we're going to see earnings from Dillard's, Snap. We're going to see Symantec, Wendy's, and Whole Foods. Now, I'm most interested on what happens on Thursday. Because on Thursday, we have, okay, the wholesale inflation numbers, and we're going to see new jobless claims. Okay, that's good. But we're going to see earnings from Kohl's, Macy's, and Nordstrom. And we know how there's been, and we've talked about this whole change in the way of buying habits for individuals. Consumers have been flocking towards online and really shunning the malls. The big box companies have started to cut prices, close stores, and they're in a bit of a death spiral, to be honest with you. So I would look at this as a good indicator of what's going on with retail sales. And then we're going to follow it up on Friday with the actual retail sales numbers for April. We're going to see some consumer inflation data. So you get the PPI earlier in the week and the CPI on Friday. And from there, we're going to see the University of Michigan's initial May Consumer Sentiment Index and earnings from JCPenney. That's going to round out the week. Now, just going back to last week for a second, just to talk about this. So when we looked at the probably the most important economic news of the week, we did see that there was some early in the week, this discussion of personal income and personal spending and PCE prices. Prices definitely came down a little bit, which is, that is one of the favorite numbers of the Fed to look at actual inflation. Inflation is, I would say, it's leveling off again. We saw a bit of a spike and now it's leveling off again. Some of that is due to the fact that crude is now 46. Commodities have come down in price and that is weighing on inflationary numbers. But when you strip that out and you look at the rest of the inflation numbers, they're still pretty much on a higher trajectory. Trend higher. But getting into what we saw on Friday. So we saw again that there was estimations of about 180 to 190,000 jobs added. 211 were actually added. On the private side, we were expecting about 180. It was 194. The unemployment rate was a very surprising drop to 4.4 from 4.6. But when we get into the average hourly earnings, even though income is up, as we mentioned, average hourly earnings still is not increasing, nor is the average work week. But consumer credit is growing again. So again, this tells me that there is something about prices that just can't be goosed right now by any means. And we're seeing that there is no real buying or pressure, I should say, pressure on prices from an inflationary standpoint. Upward pressure. I don't mean downward pressure. Upward pressure. And without this upward pressure, we're not really seeing the need for, even with a full employment situation, we're not seeing that wages are going up at all. So maybe that's added to the mix there. But meanwhile, people are taking out much more credit. Expectations were for about $14 billion in consumer credit being added for the month, and it was actually $16.5 billion. That was for March. So confidence up is pushing people to expand their credit, but yet not spend. Again, it's very strange. Do you see? Can you? If you listen to everything I just talked about, you'd have to agree that something is a little off here. I'm not exactly sure what it is. Can't put my finger on it exactly, but something's a little bit strange when it comes to all this. Now, I did mention that I got back from Cuba. Hello, Mike. Back from Cuba. That was a combination Australian and Cuban accent right there. you know, I'm a cigar smoker. You all know that. I enjoy my daily cigar. I had this vision. I had this vision that I'd step off the plane, arrive in Cuba, and everyone, I mean, men, women, and children, would all be having cigars hand-rolled everywhere I went. Smoking them. I don't mean just having them. I mean, it would be, you know, it's like a cigar paradise. That's what I thought. Did you have that vision? I can add into the fact that, I figured everybody's going to be wearing guayaberas, you know, those linen shirts with the multiple pockets that you wear out with a nice little design on it. I thought mojitos would be everywhere and daiquiris. And everybody would be wearing these Cuban-style little hats. You know, straw hats and, you know, these really cute Cuban-style hats, smoking a cigar with a mojito in their hand. Nothing could be further from the truth. What I found fascinating was the first day, we looked around. I figured there'd be stores. You know, you could just pop in a store and buy some cigars, whether you get the Romeo and Julieta or the, you know, the Monte Cristos, or you can get the Cohibas or something. Partagas. All these wonderful names that you know of that, you know, are Cuban, from originated in Cuba. Nothing. The place is pretty, I don't know if you've been there, it's pretty filthy. It's a mess. Most buildings are halfway either built or halfway falling down. I'm not sure which is which. Partially painted, rusted. Again, I don't know if they partially painted it or the paint fell off. I'm not sure what. I would lean towards the side that they're actually were fully built and fully painted at one time and now have been disintegrating over time because there's been no major building infrastructure expanding or anything that's going on down there, except for just hoping that everything stays up and living their life as best they can in a socialist slash communist slash non-democratic style, non-capitalistic style economy. And obviously we shut them off many years ago. It was cool that all the cars, you know, the 1950s American cars and convertibles were there. That was kind of cool. Many of them had Russian engines, but I was really surprised. I had this idea, maybe it's my fault. Maybe I didn't want to think anything other than this, but it was very much just a poor Caribbean island that needs a tremendous amount of work and finally lifting, you know, or when the day the embargo finally lifts, and if it lifts, that they'll get a lot more development there. Hardly any internet to speak of, no cell phone service unless you want to pay a tremendous amount. In our Airbnb, we had 2 hours of internet in the morning available and 2 hours in the evening. And the only way to get cigars with a reasonable price was kind of a backdoor way of your someone in your hotel or in your Airbnb where you're staying would come in and say, we have these cigars. Whether they were real or not, I couldn't tell you. I think they were. But it was really interesting that there was really no way to find. There was a few places, but not at all what I expected. And again, a lot of road work was being done. The mojitos were good, by the way. That I give them props for. The mojitos were made with the muddling of the mint and the rums and excellent. But when I'm asked by a lot of people, well, would you go back? Should I go? I'm just saying. Maybe not. All right. let's talk a second. We're going to get some listener questions in a moment. Let's segue to just a couple of questions we have from listeners. One, I think it's more like one question and a comment. If you want to ask me a question, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. On the top, it says Ask Andrew. Click that button. Ask away. We'll try to get your question on a show, or we will answer it directly. We actually answered a good amount of questions directly because I don't know what was going on, but they were kind of complex. A lot of really complex questions, not those that would really be appropriate for an episode. So I simply just answer them directly. So if you have any questions, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can check out all the other things that are on there from the show notes, all about Arrow, Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, the Global Allocations, Investology, all those great opportunities we have for you in order to invest. So I encourage you very strongly to do that and check all those out. In the meantime, we have a question from Wayne P. He says, since the Fed might raise interest rates soon, would it be a good idea to move a larger portion to bond funds as opposed to equity funds? You know, that's a good question because there seems to be no fear about the Fed raising rates and the effect of what that will do to both bonds and stocks. The Fed has come off quite hawkish recently. And I'm not talking about just the last meeting, but if we look back over the last 6 months or so or 8 months, the Fed has been a lot more hawkish than they have been dovish as compared to where they were over the last 10 years before that. And still, equities don't sell off. And for the most part, bonds don't really sell off. As a matter of fact, the 10-year was at what? 230? 230 on the 10-year. And it hasn't moved. So all this anticipation about this is really not doing much. Now, the yield curve has changed. We see that clearly that there has been a rise in the shorties and the long-term rising also. But again, compared to about a year ago, it's a little bit wider than it was, but still nothing major. It appears that somehow bond investors are still concerned about something out there. They're not giving up their bonds. They may be thinking, well, why should I give up my bonds? The Fed's not going to roll it off at this point. They're going to keep on buying bonds through the quantitative easing program that they've been doing. And for those of you that don't know, they still are buying bonds at about $40 billion per month with interest rate payments, as well as redemptions, maturities. They're taking those and rolling them right back into more bonds. So the question that Wayne asks is, should I move a larger portion of my equity funds to bond funds, into bond funds from equity funds? Here's what I think. It makes some sense to take some profits off of your equity funds that you've made recently and put them into very short-term bond funds that have a decent yield. I would go with that. Until we see any signs, crazy things have happened, that all of a sudden there's going to be a crash on a Tuesday. Right now, it seems like no matter what happens, buyers are stepping in. Interest rates are very low. There's plenty of liquidity out there. Margin debt is at, an all-time high right now. Leverage in the markets is at an all-time high. That could be the canary in the coal mine. That could be something that is something we need to really look at and be concerned about. I'll give you that. But other than that, really, every single dip has been bought. Now, will that continue forever? I'm telling you right now, mark it down. No, absolutely not. You're not going to see that kind of situation go on forever. But right now, the market environment is really feeding on this whole idea that taxes are going to be lower in the future. So, again, back to this, would I take my money out of the equity funds? We have not really taken down significantly, a small amount, but we have not taken down our equity exposure right now. But you need to be on the alert. Maybe I'll shift this a little bit, not answer your question with a yes or a no, but you need to be on alert. You need to be ready. So you need to do the research to figure out what it is that you actually want to be in when you make this change. When you maybe sell some of your equities and decide to move into bonds. And by the way, I'd also have this when markets do correct eventually. Have a game plan of, okay, when that happens, what do I want to be in? What do I want to go back into? I want to take out some of my bonds and put them back into equities at that point? And if I do, what is the plan? So this way you don't have to scramble around at the last second and say, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Should I do it? No, I'm not going to do it. It's going to go lower. I don't make a plan. We talked about this 100 times. Need to be prepared. You need to be disciplined. You need to have an understanding of the emotional aspect of this whole market environment. And at the same time, make sure that you are ready to act and have it well thought out in advance. So that kind of gives you a little bit of an answer to that question. That's not the first time that question has been asked, by the way. Thanks for the question. Rick asks me, he says, a great, great podcast. Thank you so much. He says, he's talking about protectionism. And he said, he'd be worried if we had true free trade, but considering the barriers we have to sell our goods in most Asian countries, free trade is a myth. Just look at the trade information and imbalances that we have, the environmental mess in China and near slave labor practices. We have been in a trade war for decades, but we just refuse to fight it. I would kind of agree with that. Now he talks about a variety of things. I don't know if there's a question here somewhere. I guess ask me a couple of different things here. Oh, he says, talking about an opioid epidemic. Went on and on here. I'm worried about my teen kids' futures. Are you worried about your kids? Yeah, the global free trade system is just working dandy for us. Sarcasm. Anyway, so Rick, I don't really think you... I would agree with most of this here. I don't know if there's a question in this. Yachts in the Hamptons. A lot of discussion here. But bottom line is, yeah, I think that free trade is a myth. I agree with you on that. Protectionism is the opposite and antithesis of that also. And I think there's some kind of a... I think there's a lot of give and take. I think that we get certain products in that are cheaper from, let's say, China. And maybe, we have products that are not as cheap, but maybe we'll use those and send ours off. And there is the potential for China or Germany or pick your country. It really doesn't matter. To have a cheaper product that they're spilling off the market, that's not good either. But now we're about to enter into a trade war over lumber and milk. With Canada, we're embarking on the destruction of the relationship with Mexico and America. So basically, to the north and to the south, we're pretty much saying screw you right now. I don't know if that's going to play out either. The hope is that we'll just buy American. But remember something: American isn't American as much anymore. It's global, whether you like it or not. It doesn't matter whether it sounds good to you or not. Doesn't matter. Here's the fact. We do a tremendous amount of exporting and we do a tremendous amount of importing. We source out and we source in. We get some goods that are cheaper from other places, and that's what consumers want. If you looked at the consumer trends and why certain stores are doing better than others and why certain products are doing better than others, it has to do with pricing. Everybody is very, very, very in tune with what the pricing should be and what prices are. So if we, in fact, cut off one area that supplies us with cheaper products that we're willing to accept as the appropriate quality and acceptable quality, and go with another product that has the same quality, let's call it, or maybe a little better, but a lot more expensive, I am telling you, you're going to have a problem with consumers. And there's one little other thing, just a small item. If, in fact, you go and do that, the other problem you have is inflation. If prices go up and people buy it anyway, you have inflation. That's not good either. So I think we need to rethink this whole thing and, again, question, are things really that bad? Yeah, for some areas they are. I'll give you that. We need to straighten that out. No question. But when we look at the totality of the circumstance, not so bad. Not so bad at all. If you do want to ask us questions here and maybe suggest a guest or ask me about what my thoughts are on, copper, a particular stock, whatever it is, you can just go over to the disciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew. We enjoy the questions and hearing from you. So I thank you for all the people that have sent in the past. And thank you. Don't be shy. Don't be shy. I don't know. He's going to like my question. Don't be shy. Get on. This is your opportunity. It's freebie. Hello. It's a freebie. You get your questions answered. So go over to disciplinedinvestor.com. Ask Andrew. All right. What else do we have to talk about? I think we kind of exhausted a lot of the topics here. Let's see here. Let me just look through here real quick. Oh, no. We did not. We have something. I forgot about this. You know, with the U.S. dollar moving below its 200-day moving average, about 98.56 is where it closed. 200-day moving average just right above. It's well below its 50-day moving average as well. You have to wonder, hey, wait a minute. What about gold? What's going on with gold? Gold's at 1228 or so on the close on Friday. And I wonder if we do see a jump in the euro moving forward, if we're going to also see the potential for gold to rebound pretty strongly here. Now, what if two things can happen with gold? I think the reason that gold has been slipping is because we see also the VIX slipping down to about 1050 here. But with the VIX slipping, because nobody's really concerned about anything and whether that's complacency or reality that there is nothing to be concerned about, right? You can look at it two different ways. That gold also has that question about, well, if it's not a really risky environment in the markets, why do I need any kind of protection and why should I diversify into hard metals? And gold doesn't have any intrinsic value anyway. And, you know, you can make up all that those stories. But gold, if in fact we do see the euro jumping very substantially and the dollar coming down, which we have seen, you got to wonder whether or not this is going to be something good for gold moving forward. And I do think that gold still has an opportunity, especially with all the, I would call it the global geopolitical concerns that we have right now. So gold in the GDX, the gold miners ETF, in particular, the GDX is a very highly levered towards the price of gold, but it hit a major support point last week. Take a look at GDX and something that you may want to look into if you haven't been invested in gold. I like gold at certain times, so I'll bring it up when I like it and then kind of lay off it for a while. But gold at these levels are kind of something I'm liking a little bit, and particularly like the gold miners at these levels. So take a look at that. That's going to wrap it up. Hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you're having a great weekend. Hope you have a great week ahead. And again, any questions you have, just ask me. If you also want us to take a look at your portfolios, go over to the Disciplined Investor. And that's a wrap. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.